This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Institutional trust. Let's talk about what's happening in the world in our medical institutions. Senator Ron Johnson is here. Carol Roth joins us. Why is Trump about to declare an economic emergency? All that and more coming up on I'm Right. So before we get into our medical institutions specifically, I just wanted to talk to you again about institutional trust, institutions, nations, how nations remain, because I see something happening globally right now in many, many, many places. Honestly, many places considered to be Western civilization, I see this happening. It's happening here in the United States of America, Canada, UK, of course, France, Germany. I see this happening. A very, very common thing throughout history is happening, and this is how it oftentimes goes. A country will be established somehow, some way, and then the country will begin to flourish and grow. People will be happy, prosperous. And over time, the institutions on which a nation is built, remember, nations are built on their institutions. They are the pillars that hold your nation up. Your government, your education, your religion, your entertainment, your various things. Those are institutional things that create a country. Over time, the institutions will become corrupted. As the people check out, get too comfortable, lazy, whatever word you want to put on it, the institutions will be infiltrated and conquered by evil, corrupt people. And once the institutions become corrupted by evil people, the institutions will begin to serve themselves instead of the nation. You know, the education institution of a country, it actually should never be to serve the education. It should be to serve the country. That should be the ultimate goal. The government, people inside the government shouldn't exist to serve the government, to better the government, enrich the government, expand the government. The government should exist to, well, help the country, serve the country. But once it's conquered by evil, selfish people, that changes. The institution focuses inward, focuses on itself. And after that corruption happens, the institution will do terrible things. It will lie. Evil act after evil act will happen. And the people themselves will know it. No matter what. No matter what age you're in. Today, we all have cell phones, right? You can read about it. But no matter what age you're in, the people will begin to pick up on the fact that this institution is turning evil, selfish. And then something disastrous happens. The people will begin to separate from the institution. They will begin to view the institution as the enemy instead of a necessary pillar holding up society. And once you get to that point, the end of that country is in sight. I'm not saying it's happening tomorrow, but you have to have trust between the people and their institutions or the country will end. You cannot have this separation and continue to exist as a country. It doesn't work. And I see it happening globally right now. I know you see it too. Institutions have already broken the trust. Time after time, issue after issue, they've broken the trust. And they're all, virtually all of them, except for here in America, which we'll get to in a moment, but virtually all institutions now are doing what they always do. And it blows me away, because the lesson of history is quite clear. The institutions, instead of trying to earn back the trust of the people, open up the books, hold people accountable, instead they double down, triple down on all the evil, selfish things, thus bringing about the end of the country much faster than it would have happened otherwise. Here in the United States of America, our institutions are evil and corrupt as well. Evil, corrupt, dishonest. We don't have to look very far back in history to see an example of just how evil, corrupt, and dishonest our institutions are. Remember COVID?
You really should, in an indoor setting, a congregate setting, be wearing masks. It's just the appropriate thing to do to protect yourself and your family.
Our data from the CDC today suggests, that vaccinated people do not carry the virus, don't get sick.
Ivermectin is something more often used to deworm horses.
If we really do our part, stay at home, social distance, then we can flatten our curve even below those projections. But it really depends on all of us.
I'm making the personal sacrifices not to infect my parents and my pregnant daughter. I worry about that because then it gives people the option to say, well, if bars and restaurants are open, then I can have 20 people over for Thanksgiving. And so I don't like it to be any number. I like it to be keep it to your immediate household.
That, obviously, we could just play a montage that lasted the whole show. Those were all lies. Every one of those people was lying, and they knew they were lying. Every one of them. Lying. Evil. And as they told lie after lie after lie while your life was being destroyed, while you had to say goodbye to your dying mother on Zoom, you couldn't have a funeral while your child lost their ability to read, that trust began to shatter between our medical institution and this country. And then, of course, the vaccine, which of course is not a vaccine at all, it's a therapeutic of some kind, created by and through Operation Warp Speed. Operation Warp Speed was terrible, one of the most evil things this country has ever done. That poisonous shot harmed numerous people who are still out there searching for justice. Maybe that's you watching right now. And up until recently, even Trump was still touting it.
Despite COVID, which was a very unfortunate situation for the whole world. We did a great job with it. Never got the credit for the job we did. Operation Warp Speed, people say, is one of the greatest achievements ever in politics or in the military, because it was almost a military procedure. But everybody, including Putin, said that Operation Warp Speed, what you did with that, nobody can believe it. And we did a great job.
It wasn't great. It was horrible. It was evil. It was wrong. Now, Donald Trump has to own that. Has not really ever done so up until recently. So what happened with Trump and Warp Speed? And I'm not excusing him, so don't think that I am. What happened, though? Donald Trump was lied to by all the people around him. Everyone's going to die. You're going to have 50 million people dead. Everyone's going to die. Do you want to be the president when 50 million people die? They're all going to die. A lot of death, mass death. Mr. President, we need a vaccine now. We could get one ready to go. We need this done now. Fast track this thing. Gigantic fat handout to pharmaceutical companies who didn't have to jump through any more hoops to make sure it was safe. And out it goes. And now we have pregnancies being terminated by the million. We won't even go into that little number. Donald Trump was lied to, bought into the lies, pushed it, and people died. But Donald Trump has really, really solid people around him now that, to his credit, he has brought into the administration. Dr. J, Marty McCary, several others, smart people who know the truth about this stuff. And Donald Trump is now hearing the truth, and he put out this statement, quote, "It is very important that the drug companies justify the success of their various COVID drugs. Many people think they are a miracle that saved millions of lives. Others disagree. With the CDC being ripped apart over this question, I want the answer, and I want it now. They show me great numbers and results, but don't seem to be showing them to many others. I want them to show them now to the CDC and the public and clear up this mess one way or the other. I hope Operation Warp Speed was as brilliant as many say it was. If not, we all want to know about it and why." Now, I know if you are somebody still angry about all that, that that seems like a small thing, and it is, but it's also not. That is a huge first step, and I will say this, that's more than is happening in any other Western country to earn back the trust of the people in their institutions. You can say it's small. Okay, it's small. No one's doing that in Canada. They're all doubling down, tripling down. No one's doing that in Germany, in France, in the UK. It's not happening anywhere else in the Western world. It is slowly happening here. Bad people are being removed from the government. The Trump administration, acknowledging when mistakes are made and fixing those mistakes, like this Susan Monterez. Trump had someone else in mind to head up the CDC. Of course, Big Pharma didn't like him because they're a bunch of evil, poisonous scumbags. So they own a bunch of United States senators, including Republicans like Bill Cassidy of Louisiana. They torpedoed his nomination. Trump went with this Susan Monterez girl for some reason, because there were red flags all over the place.
What can we do to ensure that at steady state, not just in response to a pandemic, but at steady state, that we have an open and inclusive and fully benefiting clinical trial network, so that we can ensure that it's equitable, that it's accessible, that it isn't just skewed towards a demographic or a geographic or a patient population, but we actually have an inclusive clinical trial network?
You heard all the buzzwords. She's a dirty communist who never should have been there. Well, now she's gone, and that's a good thing. Keep in mind where we were. I just mentioned we have Dr. J and others involved now with the national health institutions of this country. Keep in mind where we were. Remember when they tried to create a new pandemic scare out of this monkeypox thing, and they brought in this muddy buddy on TV to tell you about it?
Sure.
The confusion that exists, the misperceptions.
Yeah, so I think, you know, this virus transmits through very close skin-to-skin physical contact, often in the setting of sexual exposure. But there are other mechanisms for its transmission, including if you touch objects that individuals who've had monkeypox touch, or if you have prolonged exposure to respiratory droplets. With that said, signaling to people who are in the gay, bisexual, other men who have sex with men communities, and also transgender people who have sex with men, that it's really important to have awareness that it's circulating in the community is really a critical part of the messaging, while not generating inordinate concern and really focusing on the infection as linked to an identity. So it's just an infection, it's not linked to an identity, it just happens to be in the social network.
No, it's linked to an identity. It's a gay disease that only affects people who engage in gay activity or the dogs they couple with. Yeah, you forgot about that story, right? Those were the people who were in charge of America's health institutions. Of course, that dude resigned because we're getting rid of a lot of the bad people in the CDC. Now, he's the shining star on all the morning shows trashing the Trump administration.
We're seeing the tip of the iceberg. So right now, I think probably the most prominent demonstration of that is what Secretary Kennedy did with changing the childhood schedule for COVID-19. In that, we were directed that only children with underlying conditions would be the ones that should qualify for vaccination. That's not what the data shows. I mean, from my vantage point as a doctor who's taken the Hippocratic Oath, I only see harm coming. I may be wrong, but based on what I'm seeing, based on what I've heard with the new members of the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, or ACIP, they're really moving in an ideologic direction where they want to see the undoing of vaccination. They do want to see the undoing of mRNA vaccination. They have a very specific target on COVID, but I do fear that they have other things that they are going to be working on. Hepatitis B vaccine is on the agenda for the meeting in September. I predict that what they're going to do is try to change the birth dose of hepatitis B vaccine so that kids don't get it when they're born.
Yeah, kids shouldn't be getting that when they're born. These were the people who were in charge of the institutions. They're being removed now. Be grateful that at least some of our institutions are attempting to bring that trust back, to create that bond again. Is it enough? No, it's not enough yet. It's more than we've had. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. One of the very few positives that came from COVID was I got to discover chalk. Wonderful, natural herbal supplements, the best I've ever had in my entire life. I discovered chalk because while everyone else was panicking and running for the hills, chalk was telling people to go outside, get some exercise, take the stupid mask off your freaking face. The most hardcore anti-communist company I've ever dealt with in my entire life. I take a male vitality stack from chalk every single day. Keeps me full of pep, keeps me feeling good every single day. They have female vitality stacks. They have a great all-natural pre-workout. They have whatever you need. Chalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. All right, let's talk again about the world of make-believe. Why are American Democrats so nuts? Why are they so frantic all the time, so angry all the time, so violent all the time? Because they live in a world of make-believe that has been created for them by the American media. They never seek out alternate forms of media. They're not sitting here watching I'm Right. They watch ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, and they think, even if they know it's biased, even if they're getting biased information, they think they're getting some kernel of truth. But this is the problem. They're not getting any kernel of truth. It's kernel-less. I don't think that's an actual word, but you understand exactly what I mean. There's no truth. They live in a world of make-believe. For instance, you probably remember CBS 60 Minutes sitting down with Kamala Harris when she was pulling behind at the time, and they sat down with her trying to fluff her up, if you will, trying to pretty her up, make her look better, smarter to the American public. Courtesy of Mays Moore, here's a little montage of what she actually said versus what they showed.
But it seems that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not listening.
Well, Bill, the work that we have done has resulted in a number of movements in that region by Israel that were very much prompted by or a result of many things, including our advocacy for what needs to happen in the region.
But it seems that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not listening.
We are not going to stop pursuing what is necessary for the United States to be clear about where we stand on the need for this war to end.
Now, let me be clear. That's not editing. That's not bias. That's lying. That's lying to make Kamala Harris look good. That's lying so Kamala Harris can win an election. Donald Trump famously sued them, and they famously settled $16 million later. They just wrote a check for $16 million because they knew they lied, and I'm sure discovery would have been pretty spicy behind the scenes. Now, one of the most revealing parts of that was what came after, the reaction that came after. Remember Scott Pelley? Now, keep in mind, I just showed you the video. They lied. They outright lied. Remember what Scott Pelley said about it?
But in this moment, this morning, our sacred rule of law is under attack. Journalism is under attack. Universities are under attack. Freedom of speech is under attack. And insidious fear is reaching through our schools, our businesses, our homes, and into our private thoughts. The fear to speak in America. Diversity is now described as illegal. Equity is to be shunned.
Journalism is under attack. That's what he thinks journalism is. Lying on behalf of Democrats. To him, that's journalism. If I can't lie to help Democrats, how can I do my job? And they just did the same thing to Kristi Noem, went on the news, CBS, credit to her for putting this out there. This is what she said versus what they showed.
And the one thing that we will continue to do is to make sure that he doesn't walk free in the United States of America. This individual was a known human smuggler, a MS-13 gang member, an individual who was a wife beater, and someone who was so perverted that he solicited nude photos from minors. And even his fellow human traffickers told him to knock it off. He was so sick in what he was doing and how he was treating small children. So he needs to never be in the United States of America, and our administration is making sure we're doing all that we can to bring him to justice.
That's not bias. That's not editing. That's lying. And that is why by the liberal Aunt Peggy in your life, whether it's your mom or your daughter or your coworker or your husband or your son or your neighbor, that is why they believe all the way a bunch of things that have no basis in reality whatsoever. Because what goes into your eyes and ears matters a lot. They are in a bubble, a world of make-believe that is constantly being maintained by the evil communists who run America's media. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is the American right is waking up to this fact and exposing this fact. The Trump administration is actually really good about this. They're starting to film these things themselves and then broadcasting the full interview while openly attacking the media. No more being the low-T GOP and whining about hypocrisy. No, 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 no. Call them filthy liars to their faces and expose them to the world. Maybe, just maybe, your liberal Aunt Peggy can break out of that prison one day. Fingers crossed for her. All right. Now, Congress is back in session. We'll talk to Senator Ron Johnson next about the big spending bill, which I'm sure is coming for your wallet, before we talk to him. Let me save you some money because Congress is about to spend all yours. Let's get you a Pure Talk phone plan. You don't need a Verizon phone plan. You don't need an AT&T phone plan. You don't need T-Mobile. You're paying too much money. Way too much money. Not a little. Way too much money. I had the best case of sticker shock ever when I switched our family from T-Mobile to Pure Talk. Half. We now pay half of what we were paying. And remember, you're not sacrificing anything. Keep your phone. Keep your phone number. Or get a new one. They have new ones they'll sell you. But you'll pay so much less, save some money, and you'll stop sending your money to a company who hates you. PureTalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. Well, I do have some bad news. Well, good news and bad news. The good news is Senator Ron Johnson is here, but the bad news is Congress is back in session, so I'm sure we're about to get screwed in one way or another. So joining me now, Senator Ron Johnson from the great state of Wisconsin. Okay, Senator, before we get into the spending, which I have no doubt is coming, and we'll be told that we have to pass it or the world will come to an end, what's happening at the CDC? Because it looks like good things from my perspective.
Well, Jesse, I would tend to agree with you. I don't have knowledge of all the inner workings. But from my standpoint, I think federal health agencies were corrupted. I think it's been obvious, certainly since COVID, that the federal health agencies were captured by big pharma, other interests. They weren't serving the interests of the American public. They were lying to us. I mean, there's a long list of lies told during COVID. The injection was going to stay in our arm. Again, things we weren't told about the biodistribution of the injection. It's an injection. The covering up of the myocarditis signal that we know now, we have documents of that. I think there's going to be more information coming out of other signals that they also hid. So again, these agencies have lost the trust of the American public because they haven't been trustworthy. And these are the individuals that push the mandates. They're the people that covered things up, lied to the American public, and from my standpoint, I'm happy to see him go.
Senator, it's kind of a general question, but I think the trust between people and their institutions is just everything for a country, and that a country will end if that trust is broken. Do the people who run these institutions, all of them, health, I mean, FBI, media, whatever, do they realize that? Does that go into any of their heads as they tell lie after lie and then cover up the lie that they just told and then cover up for the cover up? Do any of these people care that that trust is necessary or the country will end?
You know, what I found, again, I'm not of this world. I'm an accountant from Oshkosh, Wisconsin, came here, never ran for office. All of a sudden here in Washington, D.C., and this is a bubble. It's a very thick, well-insulated bubble. And I think that's part of the problem is you have all this government concentrated right here in this alternate universe. A better idea would literally be to send out these agencies into different states so that the people that serve those agencies come from different places, not just within the Beltway here. But I think that's a big problem. I've often said that we just don't have enough people in Washington, D.C., not in the administration, not in Congress, not in congressional staff, that have any experience in, which means very little knowledge of, and maybe worse, sympathy for the private sector. They don't have a clue how hard it is to run a business and how all the rules, regulations, the taxes that they impose on businesses just make it that much more difficult. So it's just a matter of simply, again, no experience in, very little knowledge of, and maybe worse, no sympathy for. And then throw on top of that, and we'll talk about this with spending, they've never even been part of a functioning organization where you have a mission statement, where you have a vision statement, where you set annual goals, where the people that are part of the organization understand their role they play to accomplish those goals. And again, here we are. We don't appropriate these accounts, not in, you know, any kind of rational way. It's, you know, these 2,000 plus page omnibus spending bills that nobody has a chance to read. Somebody writes them somewhere. They slip all kinds of crap in there. And that's been accepted here. Like that's how the government operates. It's a $7 trillion a year entity. $7 trillion, $7,000 billion. And we don't have our act together where we actually appropriate. And again, all we're trying to appropriate is about a quarter of it. 75% of it is on automatic pilot. And they set it up that way so they don't have to appropriate it. So the government just continues to grow. And as government grows, our freedoms recede. So no, I'm not a fan of this place at all.
Senator, okay, I mean, you brought it up. We might as well get into this horrible subject. A spending bill is coming of some kind. What is coming? Is it multiple bills? Is it an omnibus bill? Is it, what is coming and how bad is it going to be?
Probably the best case scenario would just be a continuing resolution. Again, it's an awful way to run government, but if you have to do a deal with Democrats, they're going to demand more spending, and we can't afford it. Jesse, I know you know that since January 1st this year, I've been arguing that we must return to a pre-pandemic level of spending. We're not even close. You know, I laid out options somewhere between $5.5 and $6.5 trillion. We're still spending well over $7 trillion. You know, the one big beautiful bill knocked that down a little bit, but not by much, not anywhere near enough. And so probably the best situation is just continued spending at this year's level. Don't increase it. Do that for year after year after year. It's probably the best case scenario until literally we have the public demanding fiscal conservatism. Now President Trump, remember in his address to Congress, said he wanted to do something in the near term that hasn't been done in 24 years, balance the federal budget. Well, listen, no president in my lifetime has honored his promises more than President Trump has. I want to hold him to his word, and I'll do everything I can to help him with that. Line by line review, program by program review of the federal budget, nothing should be off the table. But that's what it's going to take. It's going to take like forensic accounting and analysis and information, and the public has to be behind us, because that's a big problem, Jesse. When you don't have the public demanding it, what the public wants is they want their benefits, right? They want their benefits. You can cut somebody else's benefit, but don't cut my benefit. And by the way, tax somebody else for my benefit as well. So that's the game the American public is basically playing. Tax somebody else to provide me my benefit. And oh, by the way, increase my benefit. That's the state of play in America today. You know, driving to the airport today, I was listening to Wisconsin Talk Radio. 3.5 million riders of the Milwaukee transit system don't pay the bus fare. That's like 8 million bus fares going unpaid annually. That is the level of lack of respect for law, the lawlessness that we're living in today here in America. It's not a pretty sight.
Speaking of lawlessness, look, I honestly don't want to single her out, even though I can't stand her. Ilhan Omar, there's a big story out there today that she makes $174,000 a year. Her net worth is $30 million. We hear about the stock trading all the time, where members of Congress somehow beat Warren Buffett every single year in the stock market. It's such naked corruption that seems like it should be such an easy thing to solve. What is happening back there?
Well, again, I don't know the specifics of her situation, but it sounds like she was funneling campaign contributions to her now husband when he was not her husband, and they built up a little nest egg there. And again, I don't know how else they built their wealth. But yeah, I mean, somebody like her goes from nothing to $6 to $30 million in wealth. Again, it's a weird account. It's a weird financial disclosure. They have these ranges from 1 to 5 million, 5 to 25 million. So you can really over-exaggerate what a member of Congress is worth. But apparently her minimum is $6 million. And I think that ought to be investigated. Remember when this came before Homeland Security, and we had an amendment. Rick Scott had a great amendment. Well, why don't we investigate how Nancy Pelosi got all her wealth? Now, do the same thing with Ilhan Omar, anybody else who just has this outsized wealth that they didn't come into Congress with, but all of a sudden, after serving a few years, all of a sudden they're worth millions. That ought to be investigated and, if necessary, prosecuted. We have laws on the books to prevent this kind of fraud.
Senator, back to what we were talking about before. You mentioned 3/4 of the spending is automatic. Is there any way to undo that, or is all of it these third rail of politics stuff where the second you bring it up, someone's going to say you're trying to take away grandma's Social Security and you lose your next election? Can we do anything about this spending?
Yes. The thing I continue to point out is if you leave Social Security and Medicare off the table, even Medicaid, we've got $1 trillion of other mandatory spending. It should be discretionary spending. But again, what Congress has done, because they want to keep spending more money, is they just deviously transfer what should be discretionary spending appropriated to other mandatory. And so it just becomes mandatory. And again, it's out of sight, out of control. So that's the game they've been playing. But you know, that's why I keep pointing out there's close to $400 billion that we're spending this year that if you take 2019 expenditures, plus them up by inflation and population, we're spending $400 billion more than that inflated figure from 2019. That excludes Social Security and Medicare.
Good God. Senator, thank you so much. I appreciate you. It always kind of bums me out when we talk about spending, because it kind of seems, I hate to even use this word, hopeless, doesn't it? It's the same conversation every time. Well, we can, we won't. No, no one's going to cut anything. Continuing resolution until we're all bankrupt. Let's talk to Carol Roth next.
We may declare a national housing emergency. Oh, wow. Is there a timeline for that, or is it this fall?
See, that's exactly why I don't do radio remotes. You know, where you go broadcast from the local auto dealership or something like that. Do you hear how terrible that audio is? Go to a studio so I don't have to hear everybody in the background. Anyway, I wonder what's going on with the housing emergency, this stuff. Joining me now, Carol Roth, 2 times New York Times bestselling author, former investment banker. Carol, okay, first of all, do we have a housing emergency? What is it if we do?
Well, it depends on your definition of emergency, Jesse. And obviously, we've had a lot of national emergencies that have been declared, which aren't emergencies. So in our non-emergency emergencies, I would say housing probably ranks near the top because there is at least an affordability crisis. And we certainly, you know, could use some more housing. So I think it's a good thing to focus on. In terms of what it is that the government can do at the federal level to make housing more affordable, you know, that's sort of a big question. I mean, some of the things are tangential. They could make colleges more affordable by getting the government out of college funding, which would then not burden young people with debt and give them more money to be able to compete in the market. They could try to do things to clear out some of the red tape and any of the regulatory costs at the national level. They could make more mortgages assumable. Right now, about 80% of mortgages are not assumable, and that would make it certainly certainly, more less expensive, as I should say, to get into the market and create more movement in terms of the supply side for people who, are worried about being stuck and not being able to get a better mortgage if they move properties. But some of the issues really are at the federal and local level. I mean, property taxes and insurance tend to outweigh the cost of mortgages in many locales. And so even if you can afford getting into the house, you may not be able to afford the carrying cost. So certainly a lot of work to be done here, whether you want to call it an emergency or just a very important thing to focus on.
All right, Carol. So walk me through this. These presidents all declare things to be emergencies so they can assume powers they wouldn't otherwise have. Not a big fan, but we'll set that aside for the moment. What does declaring a housing emergency give them the authority to do that they don't already have the authority to do?
I think that's an excellent question. I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on TV. This administration, as with other administrations, don't seem to be burdened by what it is that they can or cannot do legally. So I think that, they're going to try their hand in any of those things that I talked about. And probably some of those they have the constitutional authority to do. And some of them, somebody may push back on. But I do think that, working with Congress to try to create a scenario where we have more housing, where it's more affordable without the government getting, entrenched in building housing or something ridiculous like that. But things that remove the barriers certainly make sense here. And, I'm sure some of the ideas will be really great and others will probably be pulling our hair out.
Okay. Please, God, don't let the government start building houses. Carol, a lot has been made about people, especially young people, not being able to afford a house now the way we used to be able to when we were younger, and I understand all that. How much do these large corporations like BlackRock buying up residential homes en masse, how much does that come into play, and is there something we can or should do about that?
So, in my book, You Will Own Nothing, this is something that I floated. We did not have institutional ownership in the housing market, 12 or 13 years ago. And now it has become a very big part of new housing purchases, something between 20 or 25% of new housing purchases. It doesn't mean that these institutions own 20 to 25% of the full market, because obviously, you don't have turnover of every house every year. And of that 20 and 25%, some of them may be corporate entities that are smaller mom and pops. One thing I do want to set the record straight on, which I think is really important as we talk about this, because we don't want to have corporations, coming in and renting you back the American dream. And I think that it doesn't fall as much on the government as it falls on individuals to not sell your house to a big corporation. But we have to learn the difference between BlackRock and Blackstone. So Blackstone is a private equity firm that makes direct investments in companies. That is the firm that goes in and buys up housing, okay? BlackRock is an asset manager. They have lots of assets under management because you go and you invest in one of their ETFs, and then that's counted under their assets under management. But they may have, through your investment in their ETF structure, some indirect ownership in some of these companies that go out and purchase houses and rent them back to people, but they are not doing the direct buying. And I think a lot of people get confused between the two because they sound the same. They used to be related at one point in time, but Blackstone is the one that's buying up the houses, and BlackRock has all of your assets under management. So we'll continue to hammer this home. And if nothing else, you learned that today.
Blackstone also makes those wonderful flat top grills. I'm sure it's a totally separate company that I'm making up right now, but I have one of these Blackstones, and it's the best thing to make breakfast on, Carol. You could put eggs and bacon and pancakes all on one thing.
Smash
you should
burgers,
see me on the Blackstone.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's good stuff.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Good stuff.
I love it.
Yeah,
so
that's let's not sully their name. That is the good Blackstone. They are not going out and purchasing their house. They are making your home more delicious, which is different than the private equity fund Blackstone. So just so that we don't get
so true.
Yeah.
So true. It even makes it easy to toast the burger buns because you put them. Anyway, let's stay focused. Scott Bessent said there may be a rate cut. Here he was.
I believe that we're getting the signals from Chair Powell, from market pricing, that we are going to get a rate cut in September. I think we've seen from Governor Waller, he believes that could be a series of rate cuts. We've seen that from Governor Bowman. It looks like they are adopting a more dovish tone here. So it looks like we could start moving. We are in a highly restrictive monetary posture right now. It looks like we could start moving away from that.
Okay, so I'm assuming that means they think inflation's under control.
Well, first of all, I think that sitting at that diner, he was wishing that he had breakfast on a Blackstone, but he didn't. And so now we have to talk about rate cuts instead.
Right.
So, you know, inflation is not under control, you know, based on the most recent data. If we accept that data as correct, which we all know is undercounting inflation, it's still 50% higher than their target of 2%, and 2% is still eating up your money every year. So I don't know that they feel like that it's that inflation is under control. I think that the reality of the situation is that Fed policy is probably not going to influence inflation at these levels. Inflation will be influenced by a whole host of other things, including the crazy deficits that we continue to run in our national debt, but not necessarily by a 25 basis point policy cut. The crazy thing, Jesse, is that you're hearing, oh, we're going to get cuts. You heard it from Powell, basically, in Jackson Hole said that's what he was thinking was going to happen. You're hearing it from Bessent. You're hearing it from some of these Fed governors. But if you look at what the market is doing as we're having this conversation, the rates, the yields on the long-term treasuries, the 10-year and the 30-year, what are they doing in response to a potential rate cut? They are going in the opposite direction. So that does mean that the market believes that there are going to be inflationary pressures and other things coming down the pike. Otherwise, you would see it moving in lockstep with what the expected outcome is going to have. So while the Fed can influence short-term rates, those longer-term rates, which impact longer-term financing for the U.S. government, that is set by the market. And the market is saying, yeah, we don't believe so. And by the way, gold's saying the same thing, too, on a tear again today.
All right, Carol, before I let you go, real quick, are tariffs helping pay down the national debt? I keep seeing this claim.
Well, in so much as that a tariff is a tax and that they have collected more in taxes from U.S. taxpayers, from corporations, they can put that money towards reducing the deficit. It's certainly not paying down the debt because we still are running a massive, close to $2 trillion deficit. So until that deficit goes to zero, we're still racking up additional dollars of debt because that's the only way that we finance our deficits. So the challenge comes that because this money is primarily coming out of consumers' and businesses' pockets, that eventually that's less money for the consumers to be able to spend on other things in the economy. Same thing with corporations. It creates an impact on the taxes that they're going to pay elsewhere. So the question is, do we get any sort of a bump or over, when we look at this over a period of a year or a year and a half, does it actually create a drag on the amount of revenue that they're otherwise able to collect? And net, we either come out in the same position or a worse position because it's just taxes moving from one pocket to another pocket, not really creating a new source of growth, which is driving, incremental revenue, so to speak.
Thank you, Carol. Come back. We have Light in the Moon next. All right, it's time to lighten the mood. And we have a couple congressional retirements that lighten my mood. Jerry Nadler has been a piece of crap for a very long time in the House of Representatives, but he's been more than a piece of crap. He's a piece of crap who announced his retirement, but he's more than that too. He's a piece of crap who announces his retirement while also carrying crap around in his pants.
Work on this subject, not part of this package, but part of preserving our democracy. With that, I'm pleased to yield the decision.
We may or may not have added the sound effects. Still, one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life that couldn't possibly happen to a nicer guy. Also, Joni Ernst, Republican senator completely useless of Iowa, announced she also won't be seeking re-election. She has done the best she can to rebrand herself as some America First warrior, but let us not forget that Joni Ernst was by far the loudest voice in the United States Senate trying to torpedo Donald Trump's Secretary of Defense nominee Pete Hegseth before he even got rolling. I know she's done everything possible to bend over backwards to lie about that fact now and to act as if she's on our side. But one more useless senator gone. Let's hope Iowa gets its stuff together and gives us a decent one the next time. My mood is lightened. I'll see you tomorrow.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.